A lot of ships and sailors ended up on the bottom of the world's oceans in World War II. A few we knew roughly where they were, but not exactly. The story this hour is the story of one ship that was in water shallow enough for divers, but its location was not known for decades. And that was the German submarine U-550, U-boat 550. The story of its eventual location and the visit of visits of divers to the wreck is told in the book Where Divers Dare, The Hunt for the Last U-Boat. Randall Pfeffer wrote it. He plays offense and defense in the writing game, both fiction and nonfiction. He's written 9 crime and suspense novels, and his 8 nonfiction books generally have nautical themes like this one. There's a reason for that. Randall's father was a career naval officer, and Randall himself has logged thousands of miles at sea, mostly aboard traditional working vessels. Randall Pfeffer, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, great to be with you, Jeffrey.
So clearly the ocean is your oyster. How did you happen upon this particular story?
I was researching another crime novel. It was going to be set in Provincetown on Cape Cod. And on Cape Cod, there's been a persistent rumor about a German U-boat that was lost off the coast of Cape Cod in Nantucket, full of Nazi gold. And the mythology around that wreck has grown to such a proportion that people on the Cape call it the U-wish. In the novel I was researching, I had a treasure hunter who claimed he had found the U-wish, and so I was doing my due diligence and looking on the internet, going like, could it have possibly happened? Were there any German submarines lost off Cape Cod, or is this just mythology? And sure enough, up turns a spate of internet publications saying, hey, divers just found this wreck of the U-boat 70 miles south of Nantucket in 2012. And I thought, wow, I know those waters. I used to fish out there. I used to captain a research boat out there that studied whales. This is too good to be true. And so I sent an email to the head diver, Joe Masrani, and said, you know, I might be late for the party, but maybe we could do a book here. And he said, why don't you come on a diving expedition with us? And so I went on a 3-day trip with the guys, 100 miles off New Jersey, and we totally clicked. And that's sort of the end of the story. Handed the idea to my agent, and we had a book deal.
So it seems funny to me that there's always a story about some lost shipment of gold from the losing side in some war. It seems like if they had that gold, they probably would have bought more weapons and won the war.
I think that's true. There was Nazi gold. The German industrialists, by late 1943, 1944, saw that Germany was probably going to lose the war, and so people like Krupp and I.B. Farben really tried to get their wealth out of Germany. Some of it probably did make it on to submarines. I think it mostly ended up in Argentina, but it didn't, as far as I can tell, end up off Cape Cod, and it's certainly not in the U-550.
What do you say, U-550, you know, gold aside, it sounds like there was still a great deal of interest in finding U-550. Was it rare that a U-boat was not found in the 7 decades after World War II?
Yeah, it was pretty rare. A lot of U-boats were lost off the American coast. I mean, many people don't know how close the Battle of the Atlantic came to the U.S. East Coast. But in 1942, 1943, Germany sent 38 U-boats to the East Coast of the United States to attack American shipping. And in the course of 3 or 4 months, they sunk 100 U.S. merchant ships. The public didn't know about it because the U.S. government put a gag order on it, fearing that if the public knew, it would set up a general panic. Of course, people who lived along the beaches of the Atlantic coast saw explosions at night, saw bodies on their beaches and pieces of ships. But the general public didn't know. At any rate, some of those U-boats were sunk, but they were in relatively shallow water, and divers found them. But this boat had been marked on the chart at the place allegedly the place of the battle since the 1950s. But when divers went out there and looked, they didn't find anything. So it became a sort of holy grail of wrecks, because this is what these deep wreck divers live for, is like finding the virgin wreck. Not for the loot, but for the glory and for being the first one to see, to kind of see history, to commune with the ghosts of that wreck.
It sounds like they really go through hell and high water. I mean, give us an idea how difficult it is to dive to these wrecks.
It's scary difficult. People die all the time doing this. This deep wreck diving is right up there with high altitude mountain climbing and air racing as a deadly sport. For these divers to go down to the wreck at 330 feet and to come back, they have to use five different gas mixes, because at different levels, different gases are toxic. At some levels, nitrogen is the toxic gas. But think about this. Below 200 feet, oxygen, which is what we breathe, is toxic. And these guys are going over 300 feet. They had to breathe other things. And to really reduce their oxygen content and breathe things like helium.
It's pretty amazing stuff as you go through that in the book. We'll explain what the effect is on body tissues as we go through the discussion. Randall Peffer is our guest on The Exchange. His book about the hunt for the last U-boat, U-550, is contained in the book Where Divers Dare. We'll come back and talk more about the wreck with Randall and with you if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Randall Peffer, the writer of many novels and nonfiction books as well. We're talking about his latest nonfiction work about the search for a German U-boat that went down in 1944, about 70 miles south of Nantucket, U-550. And its discovery is contained in the book Where Divers Dare, The Hunt for the Last U-Boat. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions, comments, stories you have to share about maybe your own experiences with wrecks and diving, if you have some experience there. 800-838-3760 over the phone. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. The part about the gases is really fascinating, Randall, there, because when you're going down 300 feet, is it every 30 feet it's another atmosphere worth of pressure?
And it's every 60 feet.
60 feet, okay. So even so, you're talking about five atmospheres on top of you if you're down 300 feet.
Right.
And the body processes the gases. You said under 200 feet is where oxygen becomes toxic?
Yeah, 200 feet.
Wow. So that's pretty amazing, the stuff they have to bring with them just to be able to get down that far and then to get back safely.
Yeah, these guys, they actually carry about 250 pounds of gear. And actually, I think I misspoke. I think it is every 30 feet is an atmosphere of pressure. So they're down there, 10 atmospheres of pressure.
Yikes. Let's talk about the rules of discovery and salvage. They apparently differ for commercial ships and warships. And how so?
The maritime salvage law protects warships because they are often graves. And so maritime law says that a sunken warship belongs to the country for which it sailed forever, so that you can't get salvage rights to that wreck. You can't take artifacts from it unless you have permission of that government. So it's the same whether it's a Spanish galleon from the 1680s or whether it's a Russian submarine. You can look, but you can't touch. And in fact, some governments get even anxious if divers are going near their wrecks.
So were there particular constraints on Joe Masrani and the other guys who were heading down to go to U-550?
Well, they knew that they could look, but they couldn't touch. It wasn't like the German government said, oh, you can't go there. The U.S. Navy was pretty interested in the fact that they were going there and that the fact that they found it. because the U.S. Navy likes to keep a log of all the shipwrecks off the coast, particularly warships, but no specific constraints except don't take artifacts.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call here. We have Jeannie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Randall Peffer, the author of Where Divers Dare.
Hi, what a great day. I was doing spring cleaning before I called, before I knew Mr. Peffer was going to be on, and I found an old book I sent for, 10, 15 years ago, The Crystal Coast, because I was born in Pamlico Sound. My grandfather was a lightboat keeper off Cape Hatteras, and looking through the book before your show came on, it says one of the top shipwreck diving destinations in the country. Divers know the Crystal Coast as the graveyard of the Atlantic, where a collection of freighters and tankers and even a German U-boat wait to be explored. And then you came on.
Sorry. Well, yeah, let's hear about the Crystal Coast. Thanks for that, Jeannie.
Yeah, I know something about that, Jeffrey. I just did some magazine articles down on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And there are a couple of U-boats wrecked down there that are in considerably more shallow water than the U-550, and they are really popular diving sites. What makes the 550 different is that these steel ships that have been down there 70 years have largely deteriorated. And the submarine wrecks, you know, submarines have two hulls. They have a sheet steel outer hull, and then they have a heavy inner hull, which is the pressure hull. And in many cases, the outer hull is completely rotted away, so that what you're seeing is kind of like a big steel tube, and often a broken steel tube because it was in a battle. What's interesting about the U-550 is that when the divers went down, they found a fully intact submarine. I mean, so good that it could be raised. With all the sheet steel on the outside of the submarine still intact, the boat looked like it had sunken a year or two ago. So surprising. But at any rate, the Carolina coast is, Jeannie's right, it's amazing diving out there. And, of course, in that same area with it, where the U-boats are, is the wreck of the USS Monitor.
Oh, really? From the Civil War?
Yeah.
Wow, great stuff out there. Randall Peffer's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Where Divers Dare, which is about the hunt for the German U-550, which finally was found in 2012, about 70 miles south of Nantucket. It's a good history piece as well as talking about the discovery itself, so we learn a lot about life aboard the submarine. Tell us about U-550 itself. It got into action pretty late in the war from the sounds of it.
It did. It was sent from Kiel, Germany, in February of 1944 as a lone wolf with a particular mission to kind of slow down America's progress towards D-Day. Germany had a handful of super weapons just about ready to come online. They had a brilliant submarine that became the prototype for all modern submarines. It was way more advanced than their U-boats. Germany had jet aircraft. It had rockets like the V-1s and the V-2s. It had buzz bombs. It had, and it was coming almost ready to bring nuclear capability online. And the Third Reich thought if they could delay D-Day just a few months, they could turn the tide of war. So they sent the U-550 to New York with the thought that it was to do as much possible damage as it could. The scary thing, of course, is that at the time that the 550 went to New York, only one in five U-boats was coming home. The American and Allied forces had gotten so good at anti-submarine warfare and detection that it was more or less a suicide mission to be in a German submarine in 1944. So these guys didn't think they were coming home, but they had to do their duty.
How experienced was the crew, Randall, given the great German losses in the war by this point?
No, they were boys. The captain was experienced, and he had been a watch officer on a submarine with a very famous German skipper, and they had two really successful cruises, one down the African coast and another the Caribbean. So he knew his business, and so did his chief engineer, but basically everybody else was a neophyte, and they'd been training the crew for 5 or 6 months in the Baltic, but these were 17, 18, 19-year-old boys, all drafted, some possibly even Norwegians. When these guys left, they told me they thought, you know, we interviewed the last three survivors of the U-boat, and they said they just never thought they were coming home.
Wow. I was going to ask you how much access you had, and you were able to actually talk to three of the men who were aboard that U-boat.
Yeah. This is one of the great parts of the story. This book has three parts. You know, it has the battle story, which is sort of high-octane adventure stuff, and then it has the search with the divers, which again is this high energy, high octane, throbbing kind of story. But what nobody expected was that after they found the U-boat, there would be dozens and dozens of phone calls and emails and letters from families involved, either on the American destroyers that sunk the submarine, on the tanker that the submarine sank, or on the submarine. And through those letters, we discovered, hey, they're living vets from all three of these areas involved in the battle, the destroyers, the tanker, and the U-boat. So we interviewed everybody that was alive. And that meant going to Germany and interviewing the last three Germans. It was a pretty amazing story.
It truly is. The story is told in Randall Peffer's book, Where Divers Dare, The Hunt for the Last U-Boat. This is a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. You got something to add in the way of a question or a comment or a particular story that you can relate about any of the subjects that we're discussing here, because there's a lot of them. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've talked about U-550 and the people aboard. You mentioned about the sophistication of the anti-submarine warfare from the Allies, which was not just about weaponry. How much better was the intelligence by early 1944?
Well, I think maybe a lot of your listeners know that in 1943, the English broke the Enigma code, there are different codes for different aspects of the German service, but they broke the naval Enigma code. And as a consequence, the English subtrackers in Bletchley Circle in England were able to basically track all the U-boats that were going out to the front, because the U-boats would check in at least once a day with U-boat headquarters, and so all those radio transmissions, which included their location, could be recorded and plotted. So before the convoy left New York, this convoy with this amazingly large tanker, the Pan Pennsylvania, before they left New York, at their convoy conference, they were told that there was a submarine somewhere 600 miles off New York, and they were calling it Red George. Well, that was the 550, so they knew it was out there. And as we talked to veterans from the tanker and the U-boat, like the chief radio officer on the tanker gave us long, long interviews, and he was at the convoy conference, and he said, oh, yeah, we knew that sub was there, but we thought we were too fast for him. Well, turns out, they weren't.
No, not at all. And the Pan Pennsylvania as a tanker was a real plum target for a U-boat, wasn't it?
It certainly was. There was a more plum target. When when the U-boat followed this tanker, or followed the convoy out of New York in the middle of the night on April 6th, 15th, 16th, 1944, they followed the convoy all night and came up in the morning to see if they could find a target. The first target that the skipper, Klaus Hennert, saw was an aircraft carrier. And this wasn't an attack aircraft carrier. It was literally an aircraft carrier full of aircraft being taken to England and Ireland to be used in the Normandy invasion. And Hennert tried to make to get a shot at that aircraft carrier, but it sort of slid out of his view too quickly, and then coming right into his view was this enormous tanker, one of the largest in the war, the Pan Pennsylvania, with 140,000 barrels of aviation fuel. And so it was a big, fat target.
Truly. And so how fast did it go down once struck by the torpedoes from U-550?
Well, usually tankers blow up before they sink, especially one with that that much gasoline in it. But this one actually didn't sink for 3 days. The torpedo hit the tanker back aft, and the tanker immediately listed 30 degrees to port, and the stern started going down quickly, and 25 guys abandoned ship. Like, while this tanker was going 15 knots, and these guys launched without the captain telling them, they figured their ship was ready to blow up, so they just launched the lifeboat, jumped in it, when the lifeboat hit the water and the ship was still going that fast, the lifeboat capsized and the men were washed into the propeller and died. But at any rate, the tanker went down by the stern. Everybody else got off the boat. Three destroyer escorts came in and picked up about 50 guys off the tanker. And the tanker started to roll over. But at that point, people stopped watching the tanker because they were in a battle with the U-boat. It turned out that the tanker rolled over and floated for another 3 days, and the Navy had to send ships and bombers out there to sink it.
Wow, that's amazing how it held on. So obviously the attention turned then to U-550, and how were they able to drive it to the surface to engage it in battle?
Well, Klaus Hennert, the skipper, was a pretty savvy guy. He hid underneath the tanker after he took his shot. He hid under the tanker so that the three American destroyer escorts that were searching for him wouldn't readily see him, that the noise of the tanker breaking up overhead would cause so much interference on the Navy's sonar that they wouldn't be able to detect that the sub was underneath the tanker. But after an hour, Klaus Hennert realizes that at some point this tanker might come down on his head. And the other thing is that he was really quite close to the edge of the continental shelf. And if he could make a run for it, if he could get over the edge of the continental shelf, he could get deep enough that he could get below the depth of American depth charges, and he could probably get below a thermocline where they couldn't even pick him up on sonar. So he could get away. So he made a run for it. But as soon as he made a run for it, the destroyer escort, USS Joyce, picked him up. It had a really good sound man on it named John Bender. And Bender said, "Oh, there's the sub." And they just turned on and made an attack and fired 10 depth charges and caused so much damage to the back of the submarine that all the machinery in the sub was out and it was flooding badly back aft. The only thing they could do is, well, either stay on the bottom and drown or blow what was left of their ballast and just make an uncontrolled surfacing, which is what they did.
So they ended up abandoning ship. What are the prospects in either of these ships lost now, either the Pan-Pennsylvania or the U-550, for going into the North Atlantic water in April?
The prospects are terrible. The water is 44 degrees. You're functionally dead in 7 to 10 minutes. You're so cold. If you don't die in the first minute from just cold water shock. Interestingly, all the Pan-Pen crew who got overboard, well, they got overboard in life vests and or in life rafts or life boats, and so they were all picked up. But it wasn't the case for the Germans. I can tell you the story about what happened after the sub was brought to the surface, if you'd like to hear it.
I would, but we need to take a short break, and we'll do that right now. The book is called Where Divers Dare, The Hunt for the Last U-Boat, U-550, which engaged a merchant convoy in the waters south of Massachusetts in early 1944. Randall Pfeffer will come back and talk more about the story, and the story then and the story now of finding the ship when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about two distinct periods in history. April of 1944, when the German U-boat U-550 sunk an American tanker in a merchant convoy about 70 miles south of Nantucket, and the wreck of that U-boat that stayed undiscovered for the better part of seven decades until it was found in 2012. So, story of attack and battle and story of discovery of the wreckage many years later contained in Randall Pfeffer's book, Where Divers Dare, The Hunt for the Last U-Boat. You can share your comments, questions, and stories on the exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the tanker is already flipped over, and its people have gotten off. We got the U-boat rising to the surface. We got survivors from both ending up in the water. What happened then, Randall?
Well, this is where the story gets interesting, because the official story that's on the U.S. Coast Guard website, because the destroyer escorts were U.S. Coast Guard manned, and also published by the U.S. Navy, and what you would read on Wikipedia, the official story says, well, the sub was driven to the surface, and the sub came up firing, and so the destroyers attacked it with vigor, and they circled it for 20 minutes, throwing every piece of artillery at it that they could. That's the official story. Then the official story says, eventually the sub sunk, but 13 guys got out, and they were rescued by the USS Joyce. What the divers discovered, what nobody expected to hear, was that, and this is from these first-person sources, all the Americans and the Germans we talked to said, yeah, that's not what happened. They said the submarine didn't come up firing. The sub came up trying to surrender, but the Americans were having none of it. And so the Americans just circled the submarine for 20 minutes and pummeled it with artillery. And if you go online or look in my book, you'll see photos of the sub after the firing is stopped, and the tower of the submarine is just full of holes from cannon shells, and there are 13 guys on the tower just waving to be rescued. In fact, it's such an interesting picture. It was the cover of Time magazine in the spring of 1944, and kind of an emblem of the condition of Germany at that point. In other words, Germany was kind of a war-torn, sinking submarine. But at any rate, the vet said, hey, this is not what happened. When eventually, you know, the sub fired a flare, and the captain of the USS Joyce said, cease fire, they're surrendering. And what we found out is, not just 13 Germans, but all the Germans, except two guys killed in the tower, got out of the submarine. The first 40 got out and went on the foredeck of the sub because it was above water. And the first officer said, there's a destroyer stopped off our port side. Get in the water and swim to it. we've surrendered, they'll rescue you. So those men all got in the water and swam to that destroyer, and when it got to them, when they got to it, it left them.
Wow.
And this is 44 degree water. Now, coming up on the other side of the submarine is USS Joyce with Captain Robert Wilcox. And Wilcox sees these 13 guys standing on the tower of the sub that's about to sink any second. And he says, you know what? I joined the Coast Guard to save lives, not to take lives. And these men are no longer my enemy. I'm going to save them if I can. And he pulls right alongside of it, tells the Germans to get in the water. They swim to him. And then the crew of the Joyce goes down into the water. They go down scramble nets and help these Germans out of the water, because just in the few minutes the Germans in the water, they're so frozen they couldn't climb a cargo net. So Wilcox becomes this hero for saving these Germans. Curiously enough, he was violating his orders or exceeding his orders, because he was supposed to neutralize the submarine and get back to the convoy. Don't stop, because you might be a target for another U-boat. That's what the convoy commander was telling his destroyer escorts, and that's why the other boats didn't stop or didn't pick up the Germans.
Oh, interesting. Okay, all kinds of things to think about in that confrontation and situation. So nearly 70 years go by. Obviously, nobody had GPS back then, and nobody said, okay, here's where the sub went down. So were there other issues that made it difficult to find U-550 over all that time?
Well, it wasn't. The sub wasn't where it was marked on the chart. The Navy placed the mark on the chart based on the dead reckoning position that the destroyers had given, but they had been running in the fog all night, making a zigzag course. And the destroyer's dead reckoning positions were 10 to 12 miles apart from where they were. So they just sort of guessed at it. There's a lot of bottom to that ocean. It's not easy to find. Some of the divers have been looking for this wreck for 20 years. The trick, of course, was side-scan sonar. But it took 2 years out there with, you know, following a search grid and just days and days going back and forth towing side-scan sonar.
Mowing the lawn, I understand it's called.
Yeah, mowing the lawn. Fishing. It's going 4 miles and a half, 4 knots, you know. It's just deadly boring. And you have to cover every inch of that ocean. But at the last day, the last hour of the last day of the last trip, when they were running out of money, they found it.
They did indeed.
And you can look at it. You can look online at U-550 images, and you'll see the sonar image, and you go like, holy cow, there's no question, that's a submarine.
That was pretty obvious. We have a call here from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Randall Peffer. His book is Where Divers Dare.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Randall.
Howdy.
Morning.
Well, Randall, my ignorance is most profound about this, but this was my question, and I got it through the screener that this is a good question to ask. Why can't you just use, since this is the 21st century, why can't you just use underwater autonomous vehicles to recover it? And I think you kind of stole my thunder there, because it's expensive. But Jeffrey, I'll take his answer off the phone, and
right.
I'll listen in for that.
All right. So instead of risking divers' lives, why not use gadgets, robots, that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, and it's a question that we talk about all the time. With the dive team about using ROVs, which are basically underwater drones, right? You can use those to explore the wreck. You needed the sonar to find it. The real question about using the ROVs was, what about going into the sub? Because deep wreck divers, they're not content to just go like, oh, look, here's the wreck of the hull. It's like, you know, it's like, I want to be the first. I want to go in there and see the ghosts. I want to relive history. And as it happened, the forward torpedo loading hatch in the U-550 was blown open. And the two youngest divers really wanted to go in. And the four oldest divers said, you know what? We pulled a lot of dead guys, and we've left dead guys in wrecks of submarines. You can get in, but sometimes you can't get out. Don't do it. But the two younger divers persisted. And the older divers are going like, yeah, let's do an ROV. Let's just fly an ROV with a GoPro on it through the sub to see what's down there. I thought it was a great idea. I thought it was way too big a risk. But the divers, the two young divers, actually went to the university, went to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago that has one of the only four existing U-boats in the world. And it's a sister ship of the 550. And they spent hours in that submarine measuring and practicing and taking pictures of everything in the restored 505 in Chicago so that they would be prepared to go into the 550. And they went in, and they got amazing pictures, and we're going to post some on YouTube videos. Because here's the thing. When Joe went down into that forward torpedo loading hatch, he looked aft into the petty officer's quarters, and the lights were still hanging on their lamp cords and swaying in the current, and the dishes were still stacked. And it was, you know, it was like this wreckage just happened, as if the whole battle had just gone down a year or so ago. It was really spooky.
It sure sounds like it. Now, the thing, when you talk about the stuff that happens to divers on deep wrecks, though, I mean, I didn't realize that 17 divers have been lost looking at the wreckage of the Andrea Doria. And even the guys who found 550 had some close calls. And you mentioned specifically Eric Takagian. It sounds like he almost got stuck in a wreck.
Yeah, that's one of the stories we tell in the book, is Eric was diving the wreck of the USS Bass, and he'd gone deep into the wreck, into the control room. And a ballast tank fell on top of him and had him crushed to the floor in zero visibility because it had stirred up so much silt. And I'm not going to give it all away except to say he got out of there, but how he got out of there was very savvy. But as I say, a lot of people don't get out of wrecked ships, and particularly wrecked subs. And interestingly enough, the USS Bass is broken open, so access to it is way easier than going through a hole. Like, Joe went down a hole that was 24 by 27 inches wide, and he had 250 pounds of gear on. And he got stuck coming back out.
Wow. I'm not surprised. Obviously, he lived it to tell the tale about this. But Joe Masrani, in particular, you mentioned in the book, describes a real mix of emotions upon seeing the wreck with his own eyes. I mean, what were the emotions? What were the things he was feeling?
Well, I mean, I think he was totally feeling the adrenaline surges of, oh my God, I found this wreck. It's perfectly intact. This is like I'm a cameraman shooting footage for the film Das Boot. And then he thinks about the battle and the divers and all the 40 Germans who perished and the 25 Americans. And you know, he knows he's at a grave site, that this is a kind of spiritual moment. It's even more so, I think, when Joe goes into the sub and looks back into the petty officer's quarters and just sees a life that was once lived and sort of frozen in time.
What have they done since that? I mean, obviously, since it's a warship, they can't take stuff off of it, but have they really documented the bejesus out of it and taken pictures from every possible angle?
Yeah, they have. But here's an interesting part of the story. While looking for the 550, they stumbled across another target that was huge.
Hmm.
And they're going, could this be the stern of the Panpin? The Navy claimed that the Panpin, you know, had turned upside down and drifted for 3 days, and then they sunk it. But it drifted stern down. And when the divers dove the second target very near the submarine, they're going like, it's the stern of the Panpin. Now, Mort Rafelson, chief radio officer on the Pan Pennsylvania, was eating breakfast when the torpedo hit. And he told me, I just took a bite into this biscuit, and I was thinking, wow, if all the food is as good as this biscuit, this is going to be a great convoy to Ireland. Then bang, and the torpedo hits, Mort hits the floor, and his dishes hit the floor, and everybody scrambles, and these guys launch a lifeboat and die. Well, in finding the wreck of the Panpin's stern, one of the divers finds the dish. And so on the 70th anniversary of the battle, we gave Mort Rafelson back his birthday, or his breakfast dish.
Oh, that is amazing. From off the ocean bottom from 70 years, that is truly a great story. It's one of many in the book, Where Divers Dare, The Hunt for the Last U-Boat. Randall Peffer wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Randall, thank you.
It's been my pleasure, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.